From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Okay, are you ready for 1 hour of news, views, and presidential candidate ping pong? It is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I am Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Who says that these candidates have, you know, been asked every question and put to every challenge? We here have cooked up some new stuff for them. And let me tell you, Mike Huckabee, better at ping pong than you might have thought.
And a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah. Very, very funny, very nice guy. Even though I would say some of his political views are different than a lot of people in a place like New York City. Couldn't be a nicer guy. We'll talk about that. Also coming up, we've got kind of breaking news in this mining disaster in Utah. It just keeps getting worse and worse now. Rescuers dying last night as there is another collapse. Also, we're going to talk about that with this guy, Jeff Goodell. He's the author of Big Coal.
Also, something interesting happened on our blog. I just sort of innocently put up a way that you could contribute to a good cause, sort of in the vein of Brooke Astor, the great philanthropist. And it sparked this debate about should you buy something to give money to a cause. It's the feed bag. We'll talk with the woman who thought up the feed bag. Her name is Lauren Bush, and she is the niece of the President of the United States. It's this bag you can buy, and part of the proceeds go to feeding people.
The whole challenge is going to be to do the interview and not start asking her about her uncle, but we'll try.
Yeah.
We've also got the Ramble coming up, which includes a great story about, well, maybe not a great, but an interesting story, a $10 million pot bust, but there's a really, really kind of sinister angle to it. First, though, let's check in with Matt Martinez. In a few minutes, Allison, thank you. Let me finish. First, though, we've got to talk about our top story of the day.
It was another tragic turn at the Crandall Canyon mine in Huntington, Utah, where six miners have been trapped since August 6th. In an effort to find the trapped men, three rescue workers were killed last night and six others injured when some sort of seismic activity caused a cave-in. Here's Governor John Huntsman from the scene last night.
There is nothing more selfless than giving your life in pursuit of saving another. And that's exactly what we witnessed tonight.
The workers were 3 miles inside the mine when the shifting ground caused the collapse. A spokesman for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration said all workers have been evacuated from the mine. One of the injured was airlifted to Salt Lake City Hospital. One was released, and three were being treated at Castleview Hospital in nearby Price, Utah. The mayor of Price consoled the families by sharing his own personal loss. His father died in a mining accident 50 years ago. Here's Mayor Joe Piccolo talking to ABC's Good Morning America this morning.
It was 50 years ago and almost in the same spot. And so the initial sharing that I can have with that family is knowing the loss. But there's not any words that can be said when there's a loss of life related to these types of accidents. This community is no stranger to those accidents, and there are many of us who have experienced that loss to the coal mining industry.
Before last night's tragedy, rescuers were in their 11th day of trying to reach the six miners who have been trapped at least 1,500 feet below ground after some sort of seismic activity on August 6th. Earlier in the day, though, however, initials had announced a third hole was dug into the mine and they'd found potentially breathable air. But after last night's catastrophe, the future of the operation is now uncertain. Joining us after the break will be Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal. He's also a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and The New York Times. But first, let's get some news headlines from NPR's Matt Martinez.
Thanks, Allison. Here are some of the headlines we're following this morning. Jose Padilla was convicted Thursday of helping Islamic extremists overseas. Padilla is a U.S. citizen and was held for 3.5 years as an enemy combatant. He was originally arrested at O'Hare International Airport after September 11th, accused of planning to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb in a U.S. city. But that allegation was never made in court. Instead, he was convicted of conspiracy to murder, kidnap, and maim people, and two counts of providing material support to terrorists. A magnitude 6 aftershock hit Peru's capital, Lima, today. At least 5 other aftershocks struck the country early this morning. Rescuers in Peru continue to search rubble for survivors after a powerful 8-point magnitude earthquake on Wednesday. Officials say the death toll across the region has topped 500. NASA says it will not send astronauts out to patch a 3-inch gash in the Space Shuttle Endeavour's belly. John Shannon is the chairman of the Endeavour mission team. He said the shuttle was okay, and it was better not to fool with it. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's son is preparing for deployment to Iraq. Captain Beau Biden is Judge Advocate General in the Delaware National Guard and the state's Attorney General. He is part of the 261st Signal Brigade, which has been told to prepare for duty in Iraq in 2008. Heavy rains from Tropical Storm Aaron are being blamed for at least 4 deaths in Texas. The state is bracing for the possibility of several more inches of rain today, up to 7 inches. In West Texas. Meanwhile, a heat wave has gripped the Midwest and the South for 10 days now. Heat has killed at least 37 people. Memphis has had 7 straight days over 100 degrees. At least 9 people have died in Tennessee from the heat, 8 of those in Memphis. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
I think this is a defining moment for the history of mining. And we all expect to come out of this better and smarter and safer.
That's Utah Governor John Huntsman talking about the latest tragedy at this Crandall Canyon mine. Here's how one engineer described the kind of mining that they were doing. He said, it's like an apple core with a cinder block on top of it. So just kind of picture that. Following up on our big story again today, 3 rescue workers killed last night as they searched for the missing miners who have been missing since last week when there was another collapse.
It's interesting. You wonder, is the Utah governor right there? Will the Crandall Canyon mine tragedy really change mining? Now, what would that also mean for the United States economy? Jeff Goodell is author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. He's also a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. And Jeff, thanks so much for being with us. The first question is, let's talk about last night's issue specifically, this seismic activity that was blamed for the cave-in. When we talk about seismic activity, what do we mean? Is that Mother Nature? Is that the man-made vibrations from the rescue efforts? What is that?
Ali, I think that they were just patching through. You might have to re-ask that question.
I'm sorry. I just got connected, Alison. I'm sorry.
No problem. Jeff, last night there was – let's talk about what happened last night. There was seismic activity, is what it's being called in the papers this morning, that caused this latest cave-in. What does that exactly mean, seismic activity? Is that Mother Nature? Was that man-made from the rescue efforts? What is it?
Well, you know, the co-owner of the mine, Bob Murray, has made it would like us all to believe that this was caused by a natural disaster, that this is a natural disaster, that this was caused, this whole collapse and this whole tragedy was caused by an earthquake. Unfortunately, the facts don't support Mr. Murray's assertion. You talk to seismologists and mining engineers, and they all are pretty clear that this was a very large mine collapse that triggered seismic activity, that with such a large collapse it was picked up on Richter scales and other instruments throughout the West. And typically, after a large collapse like this, you do have these sort of continuing rumblings and realignments, if you will, of the geology in the mine and of the mountain. And that's clearly what we saw happen last night, was this continuing seismic activity related to the initial collapse.
So it's actually, in the opinion of the people you've been talking to, it's the mine sort of collapsing in on itself. These things wouldn't be happening were there not this mining going on.
Precisely. And there's, you know, I think that I've talked to a number of seismologists, and, you know, seismology, especially in the West here, is not any kind of a sort of voodoo science. This is very precise instruments. They're very good at reading these waves, the wave patterns and things, and they can tell with much precision that this was a mine collapse that was large, that it registered on their instruments.
Can you describe the kind of mining that they were doing in Crandall Canyon?
Sure. What was going on here was something called retreat mining, which is a very controversial kind of mining. It's been going on for a very long time. It's kind of, I like to think of it as sort of extreme mining. It frequently occurs in mines like Crandall Canyon, which have been mined out. This mine was planning to be closed in the very near future. And what they do is they get to the end of the coal seam. They mine through the mountain, through the coal seam. In this case, it was about 8 feet high. And as they go to support the mountain, they leave large coal pillars that are about 130 feet long by about 30 feet wide. And that's what supports the roof of the mine. When they get to the end, though, as they begin to come out, they start removing those pillars as they go. And as they remove those pillars, that changes the stress patterns on the remaining pillars. And you have what is supposed to be a kind of controlled collapse. But in this case, clearly that collapse got out of hand. And what happened in this mine initially was that these remaining pillars essentially exploded and shot coal out with sort of explosive force into the tunnel, almost, you know, sort of sideways. It wasn't a roof collapse. It was these pillars essentially collapsing and shooting out. And that's what we had in the initial collapse, and that's what it sounds like that is what happened last night also that killed these three rescuers.
Given what happened last night and given that description you just gave to us, do you think the rescue operations are going to be able to continue, or is it just too dangerous at this point?
Well, I mean, we're waiting right now to hear the official word on that from the Mine Safety and Health Administration, who is in charge of this rescue operation. But to be blunt, my sense is that, you know, the first rule of rescue is that you don't risk the lives of the rescuers. And having lost three lives and injured at least six other people last night, I find it very difficult to believe that they are going to continue this operation in the same way, especially since, you know, after 12 days, the chance that these six guys were still alive and that they were able to get them out alive was vanishingly small as it was.
This is getting a ton of attention, obviously, the governor of Utah saying this is a defining moment for mining. If actually this causes a change in the rules about the kind of mining they can do, the kind of risks that they can take, what does that mean for somebody who, you know, is living in, you know, somewhere, a big city or a small town? Does that mean things cost more? Does that mean they can't get coal? I mean, would we even notice it, people that aren't in the mining industry?
Well, you know, first of all, I would probably argue with the premise that this is a defining moment. Unfortunately, there have been many coal mining deaths in history and even in the recent past, and they always say that they're defining moments. And then when it comes time to passing real wholesale safety legislation in Congress, it gets watered down. The coal industry fights it, and more or less the same kind of a thing continues on. So I don't think this is a defining moment. I think that there will be piecemeal changes. I think we clearly see the need for better communication with miners. You know, it's just absurd that I can download onto my computer in my home, you know, real-time images from Mars, and we can't have two-way communication with miners 1,000 feet underground.
That's what I always wonder about. And from a technology standpoint, it seems like you could set up a system where the miners wore a little tag.
Well, Jeff, weren't they supposed to? The Miner Act of, was it last year after the Sago mine? Weren't there supposed to be all these upgrades that mines were supposed to have to comply with?
Well, there were a lot of changes, but they were all small, piecemeal changes. They you know, typically what happens with this legislation is they fix the things, the immediate things that were wrong with the last accident. So after Sago, they changed the kind of seals between abandoned mines and working mine areas, which blew out in that case and caused the explosion there. They changed the requirements for how much oxygen can be in the mine and things like that. But none of those really have much bearing on what happened here. There was a requirement to get better communication devices, but that was not to go into effect until June of 2009. So, you know, it was too late for this.
You would think if they could put a little tag on your shoe when you run a marathon that keeps track of you, they could put some kind of system in so that they could at least know where the guys were if there was a collapse. But, I mean, it doesn't sound like that's the case yet.
Well, you know, you would think. And, you know, to be very blunt about it, the coal industry, not all of them, but many of them believe that these kind of safety things are just too expensive, and they fight them. And they do not support wholesale mine safety reform in the way that they make the right noises, but then when it comes down to actually passing legislation, it doesn't happen.
Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. We do appreciate you taking the time to walk us through this pretty sad story. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the BPP, we'll go through the week in Iraq. There was a big bombing in the north of the country up near Syria. It's being called the biggest terrorist attack during the war, which is kind of really saying something.
Also, we want to know, who's messing with Wikipedia entries? Walmart? Fox News? ExxonMobil? We'll explain how they might have to fess up to their typing skills.
You know who is
coming up.
I can tell you who's messing with my Wikipedia page, which is, by the way, pretty bare. I got to be honest.
Yeah.
There's like three things in there, but my kid went in and added herself under trivia for Luke Burbank. It says, has a 13-year-old daughter named Addie.
Knew I liked that kid. Also, Fort Lauderdale's mayor has a problem with some gay people. We'll
which
explain
is
it.
Not the city. You should probably be having that problem.
This is The Bryant Park Project from NPR News. To the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk to Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. He was here in our fabulous New York studios doing an interview with another show, but then I just laid down in front of the door and said he couldn't leave until he talked to us.
So. It pretty much went like that, actually.
Yeah, that's how I get a lot of our guests. First, though, you know, every week you sort of hear these bits and pieces of information that come out of Iraq. You know, there's a bombing and then they say, oh, there's relative calm, and then there are all these like kind of military and political fights that happen, you know, in D.C. and over in Baghdad. It's really hard to kind of connect all of these dots. So we're trying to do that, which is why we have our patented segment we like to call The Week in Iraq.
Probably for these communities is much more than September 11th. In terms of the context of what these societies.
That's an Iraqi citizen talking to MSNBC about what went down on Tuesday night. Two remote villages in northern Iraq were basically flattened by four coordinated truck bombs. The latest death toll is around 250, and some estimates are that it could go up to 500. It's already the deadliest bombing yet since the start of the war, which is saying something if you think about how things have gone at times. Here's Major General Benjamin Mixon talking to CNN.
These are Islamic fundamentalists that are linked to Al-Qaeda. We know this because they distributed letters in the villages, we are told, telling the Yazidi population to leave because they are infidels.
The U.S. military thinks the bombings are the work of Sunni Muslims. They've been battling with the locals up there who follow a religion known as Yazidi. It's an ancient Middle Eastern religion. Among other things, its followers believe the earth is basically watched over by seven holy beings. The top one is known as the Peacock Angel. We'd never actually heard of this religious practice before this week. A guy, though, named Juan Cole definitely has. He's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, and he joins us now. Hi, Professor Cole.
Hello.
Thanks a lot for coming on. We didn't know much about the Yazidi followers, but how many of them are there out there?
Oh, that's controversial. You get estimates anywhere from 100,000 to 700,000. It's a small religious sect that has is mainly in Iraq, but it has some members in the Caucasus and Syria and elsewhere in that region. And they are a kind of syncretic folk religion. They've mixed together a number of traditions. They probably go back to the time when most of the Middle that part of the Middle East was followers of the Zoroastrian religion, which is an old Iranian religion. And Yazidi probably refers to the old Iranian word for deity or angel, Izad.
What exactly do they believe? I was trying to read up on them this morning, and it's pretty dense. There's a kind of a lot of different things going on. What are their kind of core principles?
Well, they basically believe in one God who's kind of distant now and doesn't interfere much in the world. But the active principles in the world are these angels and two main figures, a kind of incarnation figure, Sheikh Adi, and they have an annual ritual of pilgrimage to his tomb. And then, as you mentioned, the peacock angel, which is a very important symbol for them. The unfortunate thing for them is that the in the Muslim world, they're viewed as idolaters, and indeed, the peacock angel is identified by the Muslims as the Islamic Satan. So they're viewed as devil worshippers.
Well, that is one of the things that seems to have kind of led to some bad blood with the local Sunni population up there. And I was reading that a lot of this started, well, at least most recently started with a video of some Yazidis stoning someone because they were dating a Sunni.
Right. Well, there's bad relations between the Sunni Arabs and the Yazidis. The Yazidis mostly speak Kurdish. They don't intermarry with the other Kurds, but they speak Kurdish. And in the Saddam period, Saddam used to bring Arabs up into these ethnically mixed regions and try to Arabize them. And so he took a lot of land away from the Yazidis in Sinjar province and gave it to immigrant Arabs. And after 2003, the Arabs got kicked out. Some of the Yazidis have a strong relationship to the Kurdish Democratic Party, Kurdistan Democratic Party, the Kurds have been important as police and soldiers up there in fighting the Sunni Arab insurgency. So since the Yazidis are allied with them, since the Yazidis have come back and demanded control back over the land they used to have kicked out Sunni Arabs, the land issue is really important, and that's something that hasn't gotten reported on.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to kind of watch and see what happens. I know a lot of Yazidis have kind of emigrated out of that part of Iraq, and I can only imagine this is going to lead to some more of that. Juan Cole, Professor of Modern Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. Thanks, Professor Cole.
My pleasure.
The bombings this week, those happened, as we just said, up in the north part of Iraq, kind of near Syria. Meanwhile, to the south in Baghdad, everybody's still kind of wondering what exactly General David Petraeus, he's the top U.S. military guy over there, what his plans are for the coming year. He's got a really big report that's due out on Capitol Hill next month. He has said that he does plan to reduce troop size over the next year. The New York Times' Tom Friedman offered his take on the surge on NBC this morning. We're kind of wondering what exactly that would mean for regular Iraqis. And on the line, we have one. We're calling him Yusuf, which is not his actual name, but he's asked that we not use his name for safety reasons. He's a translator. He lives in Baghdad. Hi, Yusuf.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. We've been thinking about the troop situation and also the thought of taking some of the U.S. troops out of Iraq. What do you think regular Iraqis think about that, the idea of less U.S. troops?
Well, actually, we think that it will be a major disaster for Iraqis, because what's happening in the ground here in Baghdad especially, that we do have sectarian violence here. and most of Baghdad's neighborhoods are now wishing for American troops to control their areas because there will be no bias for certain sects. So by this, I mean any American withdrawal from Baghdad or from Iraq by the time this time it will be a disaster for Iraqis because that will mean the start for a sectarian war.
So you think it would be a bit of a disaster because, and you think other people think that, because things have deteriorated so much during the war that it now to not have those guys with machine guns would be unsafe for everybody?
Yes, for sure, yes. Because now we do have, it's not regular Iraqis who are fighting. What's happening here is major parties and Sunni parties and Shi'i parties are fighting together to seize control of authority, of power. So, I mean, any withdrawal will let them let their hands free in controlling Baghdad and trying to do whatever, I mean, killing whatever number of Iraqis to maintain their goals.
You know, one of the things that has been talked about a lot in the U.S. is this troop surge that, you know, they've sent a whole bunch more people over to try to get control of Baghdad. As somebody who lives in Baghdad, can you notice the surge?
Well, actually, I mean, as a regular Iraqi, it will be hard to judge whether any increase of U.S. military on ground will be helpful. But in general, I mean, any increase, the increase of military means that, I mean, the dependence on Iraqi army or police will be less than before, and that's what we want because we don't have any trust in the army or the police, because the army personnel or police personnel mainly loyal for their parties, for their sects.
Yeah. Well, Yusuf, your phone line is making it a little bit hard to talk to you, but I want to talk to you next time we have you on about mustache humor in Iraq, which apparently there's a lot of. We will get to that next time. Thank you very much, though, for coming on the Bryant Park Project. I think we can probably take our friend Yusuf out from Baghdad. And thus wraps up another week in Iraq.
Coming up, we'll talk to Lauren Bush, the president's niece, about some shoulder bags that she helped to design to help raise money to feed starving children. Really doesn't sound all that controversial, but it started a bit of a ruckus on our blog. So we'll get to that interview in just about 90 seconds. But first, here are some of the stories we're following for you today. Another tragedy at the Crandall Canyon Mine in Utah. A second cave-in killed 3 rescue workers and injured at least 6 others trying to rescue 6 trapped miners. 3 rescuers hurt in a second cave-in at Utah have been released from the hospital. Another is still in serious condition, Luke.
Yeah, Jose Padilla was convicted on Thursday of charges that he offered his services to terrorists. He was originally accused by the Bush administration of plotting a dirty bomb attack, but that charge was never argued in court. They brought him up on some different charges, and it's seen as a pretty big victory, though, for the Bush administration.
This is a minor point. It's one that if anybody who's listening to this wants to put on our blog and email us, his family uses Padilla.
Okay, I know that we have a certain time strictures on this show, but I could do about 10 minutes on this.
Okay, that's for another day then. But if you know what the real story is behind this, I've always heard it was Padilla. Obviously, in Spanish, it's Padilla. 10 minutes another time. Okay, here I go.
We'll put it on the blog.
All right. The South and the Midwest are baking. A heat wave has claimed the lives of at least 37 people. The Tennessee Valley Authority shut down one of its units at a nuclear power plant in Bama because the river water used to cool the plant, the water was too hot.
A magnitude 6.0 aftershock hit Peru's capital of Lima today. Rescuers in Peru are still searching the rubble for survivors after an 8-point magnitude earthquake on Wednesday. The death toll across the region has now topped 500. You can stay up to date on the latest news always by checking us online at npr.org.
A blog post about a good cause created a little bit of a stir on our website. The story of the post is that we did a thing about Brooke Astor, Luke, and she's this great philanthropist, and she gave all this money. Right. So we listed some other philanthropists, current ones, like the guy who founded eBay gives $60 million to a lab that helps kids research kids who are really ill. So after the end of the post, I wrote, hey, tomorrow I'll put something on the website that's an easy way for you to give money if you don't have kabillions in the bank. And I had seen this thing in Domino magazine about this bag called the Feed Bag. It's a shoulder bag, kind of stylish, about $59, sold through Amazon.com. And if you buy this bag, part of the money goes to the proceeds go to the UN World Food Program. So we put this up there, and all these postings started about whether or not you should buy something to donate or not. One poster wrote, "It's clear that buying something with a charitable donation attached to it does some degree of good, particularly when the item is used on a regular basis." But someone else on our board, one of our regular listeners, offered this question: "I wonder how effective buying an overpriced item in place of a pure donation is at a strategy." I mean, nobody really argues with the good works of the UN World Food Program. Reaches 87 million people in 78 countries to fight against hunger.
I love that we constantly try to pose these interesting open-ended questions to get people to comment, and they never do. And then you're just trying to write some nice thing about feeding a starving kid, and people are like, what? There's like a million comments.
Well, we wanted to talk a little bit more about the feedback, and I don't know, that might change people's opinions or just might open up more discussion. So we contacted Lauren Bush. Yes, she is the president's niece. We have to say that. And she's worked with an ambassador with the World Food Program, and she was nice enough to join us today. Hey, Lauren.
Hi.
So I understand the feed bag idea came to you a couple years ago. When did you first think of it, and how did you think of it?
The idea came, I've been an ambassador with the World Food Program for about 4 years now, and my main sort of role was to get university-age students involved. I graduated last year from Princeton, and so I was really sort of thinking of kids my age who don't have a huge, you know, bank account yet to write a massive check to an organization. So it was that sort of idea of just, you know, what would be an accessible way to spread the word and, you know, raise a little money while we do it. Mainly thinking of sort of young people who, you know, are going to shop anyway, are going to buy clothes and going to buy bags. And so that's how it kind of came about. It also actually came about as well because I did a lot of stir about plastic bags and, you know, not using plastic bags, using your own grocery bags or shopping bags. So I thought, like, what an amazing sort of eco-friendly message as well to use the feed bag while you're shopping instead of plastic bags, as well as you're feeding a child for a year. So it's sort of twofold.
Now, during your time as a youth ambassador, you traveled a lot, right?
Yes, I've been to 7 different countries where the UN operates and really seen the distribution firsthand. And what really was most hopeful, you know, beyond food aid, which can be sort of a Band-Aid at times, a needed Band-Aid, by the way, but a Band-Aid, was the school feeding program where kids are given a meal each day to go to school. In a lot of these countries where the parents can't provide food for their own children, that's the only incentive they have to send their kids to school. So in that, the through getting a meal in school, these kids are not only getting a nutrition-packed lunch, but they're getting the incentive they need to even attend school.
So if you buy one of these bags, I should have been clear about this, it will feed a kid, give a kid lunch for a year, right?
Yes, for a year in school. And it's just amazing. I mean, it's a $34 donation. It's recently, I think it might have changed to $25. But it basically, yeah, feeds a child for a whole year. So you just put that in the context of, you know, all the stuff we spend money on the day-to-day lives here in America. And, you know, all Western sort of countries, and it's just amazing. I mean, that's the price of 2 CDs, or one CD even.
Lauren, we were looking at some photos of the bags, and also we saw a photo of you, and you're incredibly thin. Are you eating?
Yes, I'm eating.
She's a model. That's part of her job is to be svelte.
Because we can get you a feed bag if you need it.
Part-time model.
I'm a big fan of food. I've been a vegetarian since I was 4, so maybe that.
Okay. Since you were 4? You decided at 4 to become a vegetarian?
Yeah, I'm a little weird, but yeah. I just couldn't bring myself to eat meat after knowing that it comes from animals, so.
Hey, is it ever tempting to you to talk to your uncle about policy after you go to these places and you see these things? Or is that off limits when you're at family events?
No, it's not off limits. In fact, actually, he's done the most of any president for AIDS relief and, you know, which is sort of clouded over by a lot of the other stuff happening now. But he's actually been really effective in reaching out to developing countries.
So what do you think about this argument that started on our blog? It was really kind of interesting. People saying, you know, isn't it, though? It's so funny because this one person wrote, let me read this to you. Where does it stop being philanthropy and start being consumerism plus warm, schmoopy feeling, or worse, consumerism plus guilt-ridding for the consumerist behavior? Obviously somebody with a bit of a good sense of humor there. What do you say to the person who says, hey, donate? Why buy the piece of clothing or the lipstick, Breast Cancer Awareness Month? Why do I need to buy this thing?
Well, I mean, on our actual tag, we really encourage people, if they want to donate further or to donate and not buy the bag, you know, we link them up to the site that they can do that at. So mm-hmm. that would be great. But the pure fact is we live in a commercial consumer society where people are going to shop and they are going to buy. So if you are going to spend money, why not know that, you know, a good portion of it is going back? And I totally think people should be critical, because there are a lot of products out there that I've seen where, you know, only 5 cents of the $2 water bottle or something goes to building wells in Africa. You know, and at least it's something, but it's sort of like, if you're going to charge people $2 for, you know, for a water bottle, you should give more away, I think. So I think, I mean, I'm definitely critical of that. And I think, you know, our bag is retailing at $60, and we've been giving 34 of each of that away, which is, to be honest, you know, a pretty amazing margin compared to other products I've seen. Mm-hmm. And as well, I think people, you can't discount the awareness-raising factor. Like, it's such a conversation starter, because you walk around, you see people wearing the bag, and I've had tons of people just come up, you know, not knowing that I sort of made the bag, and just sort of, oh, where'd you get that? What does that mean? You know, it's a really amazing way to sort of start a conversation about world hunger. And anyway, I think it's a pretty effective way of raising money and awareness.
Lauren Bush is spokesperson for the UN World Food Program. You can purchase one of the feed bags through Amazon.com, or you can always link to it on our blog, npr.org/Bryant Park, if you want to join in on the discussion. Hey, Lauren, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, too.
This is the Bryant Park Project.
You don't have this this pavement record. It's called Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain. And this music kind of sounds like a soundtrack for Aliens, this particular song. But the overall oeuvre of the record is so good.
See, I think it sounds a little bit like Dave Clark 5 Fish 2.0.
Yeah, it's. I'm telling you, it's a really... This is actually not that representative of the music. Gosh, I just wasted 30 seconds talking about the eighth track on a pavement record. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, you'll hear our interview with Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. If you thought there weren't any new questions anyone could ask a presidential candidate, think again and stay tuned. But right now, it's time for a guided tour through the more obscure headlines. We call it The Ramble.
There it is. There was a $10 million drug bust in Glendale, California this week. The 5,000 plants on the enormous farm were kind of surreptitiously watered. This is the kind of interesting part of the story. By a city water tank. It was an emergency water tank reserved to put out brush fires. As a former resident of Los Angeles, there are constantly fires breaking out in the summer. You totally need...
So they stole water from the city.
They stole water from the city and from the tank that's supposed to put out brush fires. Apparently, the marijuana farm drained more than half of the 10,000-gallon tank. Not to mention what it did to the town's emergency Dorito bag. Hey-o, that's even funnier than when I made that joke in the meeting today.
For about 10 years, France has been developing this moving sidewalk. They call it a fast-moving carpet that goes actually faster than a city bus. This just doesn't sound like it could lead to anything good, actually. It was put in place 5 years ago, and so many people tripped and fell and started les lawsuits that they had to shut the thing down. According to the Wall Street Journal, however, the moving carpet is back in business at the, let me see if I say this correctly, Montparnasse Metro? Is that right in Paris?
Montparnasse.
I've been there. I don't know if I can say.
You say the S? Dan says Montparnasse.
Okay.
Matt, who thinks he's king of all pronunciation, is probably saying something in the news booth, but thankfully we can't hear
it. It's at a train station in Paris. That's where it is. it's not going maximum velocity, which is 7 miles per hour.
There's a new website that has certain ears burning. It's called the Wiki Scanner. And what it basically does is it helps you very easily see who is editing which Wikipedia entries. For a long time, people have known that sometimes people will go in and gussy up their own Wikipedia entry or mess with their, you know, enemy's Wikipedia entry. But it was not easy to exactly figure out what ISP it was happening through, like who was doing it. But this guy has now figured out a program that makes this really easy. ExxonMobil apparently made sweeping changes to an entry about the Valdez oil spill. Somebody from a Democratic congressional campaign called Rush Limbaugh idiotic and racist and bigoted and said his 20 million listeners are legally retarded.
What is wrong with people?
Rush Limbaugh or that person?
That person.
Someone from the CIA added extensive information on lightsaber battles in the Star Wars movies. That is the best one. You wonder why the CIA has problems. Maybe it's because their agents are updating the lightsaber part of the Star Wars wiki.
And our final story in the Ramble, the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Jim Nagle. And he has some gay citizens in his town hopping mad. The mayor wants to install single occupancy bathrooms on some of the beaches to discourage what he calls homosexual activities. You know, those are the bathrooms where you only have a certain amount of time and then the door flies open. So if you were doing something in there.
We had one of those in my house. It was called Seven Kids and One Bathroom.
We should point out that Mayor Nagle only uses the word homosexual because he says he won't use gay because he thinks gay people are deeply unhappy. So as you can imagine, Mayor Nagle, not too popular with some of the gay people who live in Fort Lauderdale. However, Fort Lauderdale, popular with gay travelers. Rainbow Travel describes it as America's top gay resort. The website says, quote, enjoy out-and-out fun, wink, wink, in the sun and gay Fort Lauderdale with a choice of more than 30 gay-owned guest houses and gay-friendly properties. Here's a clip from a local show, Pink TV.
What was once Spring Break Central is now a gay-friendly mecca that has one of the highest per capita gay populations in America. I'm Bill Mantis. In this edition of Pink Planet, we explore Fort Lauderdale. What's not to love? It's warm and sunny, there are endless beaches, and a huge gay scene, making it the perfect spot for a homo-friendly holiday. In fact, members of the team love it so much, many are choosing to call Fort Lauderdale home.
Not anymore. Not after the bathroom doors fly open.
I was going to say, members of the team might not like Jim Nagle, in fact. He's kind of considered a cowboy in the area. He's raised a lot of eyebrows. But this single occupancy bathroom proposal, he's hit this nerve. The story hit mainstream media this week. So we wanted to know a little bit more about it from the view from the ground. So let's bring in South Florida Sun Sentinel City Hall reporter Brittany Wallman, who's been covering this mayor for years. So what prompted the mayor's big bathroom plan, Brittany?
Well, you know, we're lacking in bathrooms at the beach. And I think now, because of this whole controversy, everyone's going to have to continue using the ocean. because this created such a stir that they ended up voting against this. It was like a super toilet that cleans itself. And it was really, it had all these security features. And the mayor the reason he really liked it was because he was saying it would discourage the usual illicit, illegal sexual activity that goes on in the bathroom. And everyone was, people wanted bathrooms at the beach. They just kind of ignored what he was saying. But in a follow-up interview, he told me that, you know, he was talking about men having sex with men in the bathrooms and that it was a huge problem in the city. Meanwhile, the police told me that it's not.
Right.
And he made that comment about, you know, he kept saying homosexual this, homosexual that, and then he said, you know, I don't use the term gay because most of them aren't gay. They're unhappy. They're some of the most miserable people I know.
How did this guy become mayor of Fort Lauderdale?
Well, you know,
and stay mayor of Fort Lauderdale. Right. I should say he's been mayor
that's
for a while.
Good question. Well, he's been in office for a number of years, and we have very low voter turnout here. Most people don't vote. And a lot of the voters are sort of the old Fort Lauderdale crowd. And the mayor, his father owned a paint store decades ago. And and knew that everybody
that didn't sell pink paint.
Huh?
That didn't sell pink paint.
Actually, the mayor wears pink shirts once in a while. But anyway, you know, he was seen as sort of an honest figure and anti-development, and that's always a big issue here. I don't think people truly knew how – he's also a registered Democrat, even though he's one of the most conservative people you could ever meet, and he listens to Rush Limbaugh religiously and has photos in his office of himself with Ann Coulter and the Bushes.
He has gotten public support, though. There was a letter in the Sun Sentinel saying, "I would publicly like to commend Mayor Jim Nagle of Fort Lauderdale for his moral and straightforward stance on homosexuality." So what is the vibe like in Fort Lauderdale? It sounds like you have two sort of competing factions going on. And considering the economic, they call it the pink dollar in a lot of places. You got to imagine that with this huge gay tourism industry, that could be a problem if you start to offend gay tourists.
That's right. In fact, they estimate that it amounts to about $1 billion a year, the gay tourism here. It's huge. And the mayor actually went on CNN the other day and suggested that gay tourists would come down here and get AIDS.
Well, he's just really doing a fine job now, isn't he, in terms of trying to preserve tourism.
But, you know, I have the mayor's emails, several thousand on this issue, and I've been sitting here reading them, and he does have, you know, he's getting emails from people saying, "Oh, could you please send me a signed photo or a poster? You know, we support what you're doing. How can we get these gay folks out of Florida?" I mean, it's created this huge divide, a lot of people are Christians that are sending him supportive emails and that sort of thing. It's been really ugly. It's been an ugly fight here.
Sounds like it's to be continued. Brittany Wallman, City Hall reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Hey, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump over to Matt Martinez, get a quick update on news headlines.
A second cave-in at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah, where six miners are trapped. The cave-in killed three rescuers and injured six others. The U.S. is considering designating the African country Eritrea a state sponsor of terrorism for its alleged support of Islamist militants in Somalia. And a magnitude 6.0 aftershock hit Peru's capital, Lima, today. At least five other aftershocks struck the country early this morning. The death toll is top 500. News is always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Mike Huckabee was governor of Arkansas for 10 years, and now he's a Republican candidate for president. For those who aren't up to speed on his politics, he's a social conservative who doesn't believe in evolution and is against abortion. On immigration, he supports the funds for 700 miles of fence and 300 miles of vehicle barriers and erecting 105 radar and camera towers at the borders.
Yeah, before he got into politics, he was a Baptist pastor. He plays in a rock band, which is called Capital Offense. Which I don't know if that is a reason to vote for or against him. But anyway, he also is kind of well known for having been a really heavy guy. He lost 110 pounds and now he runs marathons. That's kind of his initial fame came from that.
Now, just last Saturday, former Governor Huckabee came in second place behind Mitt Romney in the Iowa straw poll, and he hasn't been considered an underdog since. Huckabee stopped by the NPR studios in New York here yesterday, and honestly, full disclosure, he wasn't originally supposed to do an interview with us, but old Luke charmed him into it.
Charming Luke, that's what they call me. Anyway, we got him to talk about YouTube and the Clintons and ping pong, and, well, let's take a listen.
Governor, I was looking at your schedule as of this week. On Monday at 5:15, you're on MSNBC, on Hardball at 5:40, on CNBC at 9:20, on Fox News, Hannity and Combs. The next day, 7 o'clock on CBS Early Show, WBZ Radio at 8:15, and then you had a little break till 10:30 when you were on Brian and the Judge, and then at 4 o'clock on Your World with Neil Cavuto. That's 2 days worth. Since you've been here at NPR, we've three interviews already?
Yeah.
Are your days just like, what is an average day like for you at this point?
You've just described an average day, if there is such a thing as an average one. It's been very intense and very busy. We'd had a busy schedule before, but after Saturday, with a stunning sort of upset in the Iowa straw poll, people have started paying attention. We've had 3.2 million hits to our website since Saturday night, as of last night. 1,000 new contributors just between Saturday night and Tuesday. So there is really this swelling sense of momentum. I kind of like it, by the way. I like it a lot after toiling 8 months sort of, you know, at the back of the bus and people saying, "Mike who?" And in fact, you know, I'd call up people to talk to them about contributing, and I'd say, this is Mike Huckabee. I'm calling for Allison. And they'd say, yes, your name was again? I'd tell them, and who are you with? I'm running for president. Okay, of what?
I'm with Mike Huckabee.
That's right. It's certainly been very different this week.
So these are pretty heady days for you. I mean, you're on the Bryant Park Project, which obviously is the top of the mountain, I think, for anyone running for president. But also tonight you're going to be on the Colbert Report.
Yeah, and this will be the third time I've done Colbert, which I love doing. It's a wonderful show. It's so unique and original. And I love it because I think politicians ought to do things that are not so traditional and conventional.
So I'm guessing you might be all right with the U2 debate. Some of your
I signed
your
up
peers
immediately. Oh,
are,
I was thrilled about it.
So
I signed up immediately.
Why do you think some of your peers have decided that they really don't want to be a part of this U2
because
debate?
Because they're so handled. They don't know how to react in an environment where they're not in control and where you don't know what's coming at you. And it's not a safe environment for someone who doesn't know what he believes. And I think, frankly, Americans are looking for a president, not so much who is an ideological clone of themselves, but I think they are looking for somebody who will say what he thinks and who will really think what he says.
All right. Well, Governor, let's get down to serious business here. Chipotle.
I'm all about it.
I had a burrito for lunch. It was probably, I don't know, 15,000 calories or something.
That's not good.
Well, this
but the
is
Chipotle
what,
is good.
I wanted to ask you because what made you very well known initially was that you lost a bunch of weight.
Right. 110 pounds of it. More than Allison weighs, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you trying to get me to vote for you?
Yes,
absolutely. That was just a bald play.
Absolutely.
For
totally working.
Look at this face. How can you turn it down?
So what are you doing on the road, though? What are you eating, and how are you staying keeping the weight off?
It's really hard when your meal choices are limited to airport food courts, mm-hmm. which mine have been often. But I find
that actually might
be
better. You know, that's like I think what they feed people in prison camps. That could actually keep the weight off.
Probably. Actually, the prison food, because I administered it as a governor, it's actually much better than the airport food courts. I've been to the prisons, and believe me, we feed better. A couple of simple rules. Number one, if it wasn't a food 100 years ago, it isn't a food today. Because a lot of things are really not food. They're products that are highly processed. And so you just stay away from that stuff, the highly processed. The second thing, if it comes through a car window, it isn't food.
If you order it through a clown's head.
It's probably not
probably food. Probably not food.
Yeah. You know, think about it. If it came through the clown's head, it's coming out of his mouth. And just think about that. Let that visual sink into you and ask yourself, is this what I want to ingest in my body? Something that the clown regurgitated into a paper sack.
The last governor of Arkansas who ended up in the White House has very different set of beliefs than you do. I'm curious, did you and the Clintons, did you ever end up in the same social circles? Did you ever end up running into each other? Did you ever seek advice from Bill Clinton once you became governor?
You know, we've had a very cordial relationship. He's 9 years older, and even though we both come from the same small town of Hope, Arkansas,
right.
He had moved away before I was born, but we knew a lot of the same people. When he was governor, I was president of the BAPS convention in the state. We had a number of conversations. You know, I've never hated the Clintons. I still don't. I have great respect for them. He made a lot of mistakes, a lot of personal ones. But you know something that I think should not be forgotten? There's two things about Bill Clinton I tell Republicans. It drives them nuts, but here it is. Number one. Don't let it get lost on you that a kid out of a very small southern rural state aspired to be president of the United States. This kid came from a dysfunctional family, alcoholic, abusive father, and yet he didn't just aspire. He was elected president of the United States not once but twice. That is an affirmation of the system, and it's a wonderful testament to give to every kid in America that no matter where you've come from, you've got an opportunity to do something extraordinary. The second thing, and this will really rankle some, again, my Republican colleagues. Bill Clinton and Hillary went through some horrible experiences in their marriage because of some of the reckless behavior that he has admitted he had. I'm not defending him on that. It's indefensible. But they kept their marriage together. And a lot of the Republicans who have condemned them and who talk about their platform of family values, interestingly, didn't keep their own families together.
And if you're lucky, you will get to crush their family's dreams when you defeat Hillary Clinton.
That's my next goal. You know, I respect her, I like her, but I don't want her to be my next president. I want to be her next president.
But you have to break out of the pack to do that. At this
yep.
point, you look at all the Republican candidates, how does someone break out? How do you break out? Is there one issue that you think is going to be the Mike Huckabee issue, the issue that's going to make you able to be top of mind when people think about the Republican nomination?
I'd like to believe that the one thing they're going to find in me is an authenticity that they really want. They don't necessarily agree with me on everything. They're going to say, I think he's wrong on that issue, or I think he's a little harsh on that one. But they're going to say, at least I know where he stands, and I believe he stands there because that's where he really is. And I think that's part of what makes America a great country. We don't have to have complete agreement, but there ought to be a spirit about us where we have respect for people who don't agree with us, and we at least take our stands within the context of, I can live with you if you can live with me.
Governor Huckabee, your staffer is outside pointing
waving
at your watch.
Saying,
you have to leave.
Go.
But I just want to let you put your money where your mouth is. You said you're into unconventional situations where you can show that you're not like every other candidate.
Right.
We want to play a one-minute game of ping pong with you out by our desk right after this interview. Can you commit to that here in front of the nation? And
do you remember when the Chinese ping pong games were going on
mm-hmm.
and how good they were?
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure you want to get smoked this badly
on
video?
Let's see what happens,
Governor. The governor just called you out.
I'm telling you, I'm gonna get smoked. That's what I'm saying.
Oh.
But I'm willing.
I thought he was a ringer. I got excited for a minute.
I was getting excited. I was hoping he would say,
"College table tennis team or something."
Let's get guitars out and have a
duel. You would destroy my that. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on, and I'll meet you at the table.
Game on.
We did meet at the table, and we have the exclusive video on the blog, npr.org/Bryant Park, and it is, I'm telling you, it's thrilling. I'd put it on par with the Super Bowl.
You and Governor Huckabee playing ping pong, something I didn't think I'd ever see when I first signed on for this gig.
Mm-hmm. We're full of surprises here at the Bryant Park Project.
And we are also over for today. Our show is directed by Dan Pashman. Super producers MJ Davis and Lauren Spohr. Video producer Wynn Rosenfeld. Newscaster and senior supervising producer is Matt Martinez. Magna Zuppa.
Magna.
Magna.
But that sounds like a
Magna.
Delicious wine, Magna Zuppa.
Magna, who did a fantastic job today. Thank you, Magna.
Hey, have a great weekend. Allison, you're off to North Dakota. I'm off to Los Angeles. I win.
And the Bryant Park Project from NPR News signs off right now.